For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we are in Daniel. We've been working our way very steadily through each of the chapters here. And I want to just start out with a basic thesis here tonight, and then we're going to go deeply into one of the passages that, as over the course of the many years of my Christian life, probably meant as much to me as anything I've ever read, for reasons that I think will become apparent. We've been reading Daniel, and the whole issue with Daniel is that God speaks, that God's not aloof, that God is not unaware, that God is aware of the human situation, that God is at work in human history, and he's revealing himself to this special kind of group of people that he has called the Jewish people, and a subset of those Jewish people, the prophets. And so this is how God wants to make himself known, through the pages of written history, as he speaks his purpose into what is going to take place, so that we all know before it happens, this is God's intent. This is what God had been planning all along. See, God could have chosen some other kind of thing. It could have been some sort of amazing experience to reveal himself to people. He could have done some other kind of thing, but what he's chosen instead of some subjective or individual track to reveal himself is to put out there objectively and publicly information that we can sit down, we can analyze, we can study together, we can ask our questions, we can dig deeper, we can go at it until we just see with clarity that there's no other explanation for what we are confronted in the works of the prophets other than the infinite, omniscient mind of God himself. And so for a lot of us, then, this kind of thing becomes very important as a foundation for our faith. And like so many of you, I find myself kind of weaving in and out of doubts, of questions that kind of come over me like a bad mood. And I just wonder, you know, sometimes, is there really a God? How do we know? And it's passages like this that God brings people like me back to say, what about that? What about that? And so some of you maybe here this evening are at that place. You know, maybe you've been a Christian for a while and you're like, you know, God just doesn't seem super real to me in my experience. I sort of wonder, you know, where is he and so forth like that. I wonder, I have my doubts. Well, that's not abnormal, okay? That's not abnormal. But God wants to come alongside you and he wants to say, let me appeal to what I have already written as a basis for you to understand that, yes, regardless of how you feel, the highs and lows of your experience, what I've spoken remains true. That's a firm foundation that you can build your faith on. Some of us here tonight aren't at that place at all. Some of us here tonight are just kind of like, well, we got drug out here by family or by friends or something like that because they knew that we were going to study this great passage tonight. So I'm just going to suggest to you, first of all, welcome. Glad you're here. And second of all, that, just with an open mind, I'm just going to challenge you and encourage you to read along with us and to think, is it possible that God has, in fact, and in an extraordinary way, parted the clouds and spoken with amazing clarity about things that he intends to accomplish in the world and therefore in your life, things that were accomplished hundreds of years after these predictions to demonstrate to you that the message of Jesus Christ is not pie in the sky, it's not a crutch for the weak, it's not a fairy tale for people who are gullible, but it is a faith rooted uniquely in fact. And so just to think that through together, I've spent, you know, ridiculous numbers of hours studying this passage and what people have had to say about it. I'm going to try to shoot at a level where it makes sense to you, but I realize at the first pass, some of this might be complicated or confusing to you. I just want to invite you and encourage you to raise your questions in the meeting or afterwards, one-on-one or whatever. Because it's really, I think, very important that all of us are able to walk away from this understanding what's being said. And you can derive whatever conclusion you want, but understand what's being said. Let's take a look. This is Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. We're just going to break it down in a verse-by-verse way. It says, starting in verse 24, a period of 70 sevens has been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the rebellion, to put an end to sin, to atone for guilt, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to confirm the prophetic vision, and to anoint the most holy place. Okay, well that, what is he saying here? What is he talking about? What he's talking about is a view to the end of history. It is to, as he says, to confirm or to seal up, as it says in a different translation, vision and prophecy. In other words, to fulfill all of the predictions that the Messiah was going to be about from these Old Testament prophets. We've talked some about this over the course of our study in the book of Daniel. We know that prophets have spoken to where this Messiah, this anointed one, is to come from. He's to come from Bethlehem. We know that because of Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. We know that he's going to be born of a young woman, probably a virgin, Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. We know his family line, the family of David from Isaiah chapter 9. We know literally scores of specific details about this person. Who he is, where he's from, what he will do when he comes. And Daniel now is saying that this message that he's receiving from God kind of puts the net around the whole thing. And that what Daniel is being given a vision of is the culmination of human history. Where God himself, through his anointed one, through his Messiah, is going to come and put an end to the rebellion that has just corrupted and destroyed the beauty that is God's creation. And he's going to bring the guilty into accountability for their guilt, and he is going to deliver those who have trusted in him from his judgment, and he is going to establish his rule on the earth. And that's what each of those phrases mean. To finish the rebellion, to put it aside, to bring it to an end. He's allowed freedom to shake out. We're able to do what we want as human beings, but always within limits, within the limits of what God has permitted. And now there is going to be an end where God says, no more. No more. And I'm going to establish my rule on the earth. An everlasting, righteous rule, he says. Well, very importantly, and really what's at stake in this passage, is the question of when this will happen. And that's really what this passage is about. When will God enter into history through his Messiah in this way? And here the answer is given, and I think we can all understand it very clearly. A period of seven sevens has been decreed. Need we say any more? Well, the modern reader looks at that and says, well, that doesn't tell me anything. What does it mean? Okay, this happens after a period of 70 sevens. Oh, that's just that same weird stuff that you always hear about with religious writings. You know, it's like, oh, be a kind of like, I have this vision. It's a vision of a yellow rose hovering over a crystal orb, and she who is to come will snatch it away. What a beautiful vision. What does it mean? Who knows? Your guess is as good as mine, and I'm the one who made it up. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that you think about when you think about, you know, religious prophecies. But what we have to understand here is that the framework to interpret what's being said was absolutely known by its original readers and can be known by us. So when Daniel says this is going to go down after a period of 77s, what he is appealing to is the word sevens in this context is just translated very literally from the Hebrew, is where we get the word Sabbath. Sabbath means seven. Okay? Now, so what is it? So seven what? Seven Sabbaths. We usually think about a Sabbath day as the seventh day, right? Am I right? Yeah, okay, thank you. Just want to make sure you're with me on this because it's going to be important that each step of the way you follow it. So if I was to say, hey, I'll see you in two Sabbaths, how many days will it be before I see you? 14 days. Oh, man, you guys are with me. Right. Now, here's the thing, though, that when Daniel talks about a period of 77s or 70 Sabbaths, it's likely that he isn't talking about Sabbath days because the Old Testament also talks about Sabbath years, a seventh year, okay? Now, which one then is in view here? How do we know? Well, the context is, I think, very clear that the Sabbath, the 70 Sabbaths here relate to Sabbath years. That's the time frame for the fulfillment of this great prediction. And I want to demonstrate this to you. I don't want to just tell you, hey, this is what I think. Back in Leviticus, this is Moses wrote Leviticus at about 1400 BC, so that's nearly 1,000 years before Daniel's prophecy. He says, when you come, this is the law, and he says, when you come into the land I will give you, then the land must have a Sabbath to the Lord. So the land gets rest just like people are supposed to rest on the Sabbath. And he says, for 6 years you shall sow your field and gather its crop, but during the seventh year the land must have a Sabbath rest. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard on the Sabbath year. Okay? The seventh year, the land lays fallow. And God is just basically saying, that's the system I want. I want the land to get its rest. There's probably a good agricultural reason for why that would be. But more importantly, it's an opportunity for Israel to really place their trust in God who provides. And to say, since God has said, we'll let the land rest on the seventh year, we're going to do that and trust that what he's produced for us in the sixth year will be enough to take us through that seventh. Okay? So it's really an opportunity for Israel to, in a concrete way, express their trust in God. Well, Moses goes on and he says, you know, like the law, there's kind of the good news, bad news thing. The good news is if you obey my word, then I'm going to bless you. But if you disobey, then there are consequences that emerge out of that as well for your nation, for the nation of Israel. And he says, if you do not obey me, then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. He says, it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living on it. So what is he saying here? He's saying there's going to be a Sabbath rest for the land, whether you do it voluntarily or I do it. Right? Well, a lot of us have been familiar with Old Testament history. We know what humankind is like, and we know what the people of God were about. We know that they did not quite get the job done here. And so Jeremiah, writing in the late 600s BC, says the whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and you will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. He's talking here now about the Babylonian conquest of Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, which includes Jerusalem. And we've been talking, that's the whole context of the book of Daniel. Daniel is living in captivity. But the prophet before the captivity, Jeremiah, says, hey, you know, that captivity is going to come, and it's going to be for 70 years. And the reason for that is very clear, as it says in 2 Chronicles 36, those who escaped from the sword, namely those who got away from the Babylonians as they were closing in on Jerusalem, were carried away to Babylon and lived as servants until the rule of Persia. This, he says, fulfilled the word of the Lord through Jeremiah that the land will have its Sabbaths for 70 years. Okay. Clear? Are you with me? What is he saying? He's saying this. He's saying that the people of God are going to be sent into exile into Babylon for 70 years because 70 times they refused to give the land its rest on that Sabbath year. Okay? They were greedy. They didn't trust God. They said, hey, if I cultivate this for that seventh year, that means, you know, a significant percentage more for me. And so God is like, well, okay, yeah, but here's the deal. I'm going to enforce that Sabbath. That land is going to get its rest. And so Israel was booted out of the land for 70 years, which means then that the Sabbath rest is going to come because of the violation of that Sabbath year legislation over a 490-year period of time. Does that make sense to you? 70 years of exile, one for each Sabbath year that only comes every one and every 7 years, right? Every seventh year. So just do the math. 70 years of exile rooted in the 70 Sabbath years not observed, times the 7 years is 490 years. And so that's the framework and the context that Daniel understands when he's thinking about here the 70 Sabbaths or the 77s. And therefore, this prophecy is this amazing hope of the end of history rooted in another 490-year period of time envisioned by God to a very different effect, namely the culmination of all that God is trying to accomplish and God is accomplishing in human history. Now, that is an understanding of this 77s thing that is universal. It is the way that ancient Jewish people looked at this text. It is the way that modern Jewish people look at this text. It is the way that ancient Christians viewed this text. It is the way that contemporary Christians view this text. It is universal that exactly what I'm describing here, that there is a 400-year failure of Israel that results in 70 years of captivity. And now Daniel is envisioning, after a 490-year future, the culmination of God's program on the earth. Okay, so there's really not, it's not a matter of, you know, well, what's your theological bias or whatever. Everyone agrees that that is basically the way it is. And I can give you details about that if you're interested. But let's press on now, okay? We need to put some things together. Now in verse 25 it says, listen and understand. Seven sevens, seven Sabbath years, plus 62 sevens will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until a ruler, the anointed one, that's in term for the Messiah, comes. And Jerusalem will be rebuilt with streets and strong defenses despite perilous times. So now, something more specific is being given to us. When will the Messiah come? That's at stake. He says after seven Sabbath years and 62 Sabbath years, that's 69 Sabbath years, multiplied times seven, okay, 483 years. Do you follow? Are you okay? Really? You're confused. The confusion comes where? Okay, let's just review then. A Sabbath is a seventh year, okay? It's a unit of seven. So he says seven sevens. How many seven sevens? 49. And 62 sevens is? Thank you, 434. He's got his calculator out. added together is 483. And that is the number of years in vision from a command that is going to be given to rebuild the city of Jerusalem until the anointed one, the Messiah, comes is 483 years. Seven Sabbaths and 62 Sabbaths. A Sabbath is seven. 7 years in this context. So seven times 7 years and 62 times 7 years is 483 years. Now, let's press on. We're going to come back to this. This is very important, but I want to read the next verse. He says in verse 26, after a period of 62 sevens, the anointed one will be killed, appearing to have accomplished nothing, and a ruler will arise whose armies will destroy the city and the temple. The end will come with a flood, and war and its miseries are decreed from that time to the very end. So now we're given a broader picture of what happens when the Messiah comes. Two things. He says the Messiah will be cut off. He'll be killed. And it will seem that he's accomplished nothing. Let's be very clear on this point. The Messiah is going to come and he is going to be killed. And the verdict would seem to be that he got nothing done. It was a failed mission. Okay, that's one thing that Daniel's saying. The second thing is that after this occurs, after the death of God's Messiah, a ruler is going to come. Jerusalem will be destroyed, as will the temple that is yet to be built in Daniel's time, is all going to be annihilated. Both of those things are going to happen at the end of this 483-year segment. Okay, so that's what we can expect. Now let's go back to verse 25 and let's say, okay, if it's the case that from the issuing of this decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah comes is this 483 years, it would be very helpful for us, would it not, to know when is this decree, right? What's the starting point? What enables us to click the stopwatch and say, time's ticking, time's ticking? See? Now, if we look into the scripture, we find some options for this thing. There are four, specifically, edicts that are mentioned. The first comes from Cyrus in 539 BC. And Cyrus gives an edict, as he is a Persian and he has destroyed the Babylonian army and he's taken over the Babylonian Empire. One of the first things that Cyrus does is he allows Jewish people to return to their homeland to settle once again in and around Jerusalem. Okay? Now, many of Cyrus's administrators were very unhappy with this decision that he made, and as a result, many of the Jewish people were not allowed to migrate back to their homeland. And so in 539, Darius, who replaces Cyrus as king, reissues that same decree, let the people go, let them return to their city. And then Artaxerxes in 457 BC issues another decree allowing more people to return to Jerusalem and to begin to rebuild the temple. The temple. But there is only one decree that history has provided for us that satisfies the specific conditions that Daniel brings out in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25. And that is the decree of Artaxerxes, the Persian emperor, in 444 BC, cited in Nehemiah chapter 2. Let's take a look at that. It says, in the month of Nisan, that's the spring, okay? In the 20th year of Artaxerxes, He said, I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor in your eyes, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tomb, that I may rebuild it. Let letters be given for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, to buy timber and to make beams for the gates of the fortress and the walls of the city. And the king granted me this, and letters were written. Now, what's important about what's being described here and what sets this decree apart from all of the others is that it's not just the permission to return to the homeland, but it is permission to build its defensive walls, to create the city, to build its plaza. All these things that are described by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, which are absent in all other decrees. And so therefore, it makes the most sense, it's the closest fit, that the beginning point for this 483 years until Messiah comes would begin in the spring of the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign. Now, when did Artaxerxes begin his reign? 465 B.C. in the fall. How do you know that? Well, because the Encyclopedia Britannica tells you so. Okay, it's not biblical history. This is just everybody's history. This is common knowledge. Everyone knows. It's a completely undisputable fact that Artaxerxes took the reins of the Empire of Persia in 465 B.C., and so, therefore, the spring of his first year would be our 444 B.C., the month of Nisan. Hey, kind of like April, okay? The 20th year, then, brings us to 444 B.C. That is a hard date. It's not disputed. Now, let's then do the math. Are you following me? It's pretty straightforward, really. There's no smoke and mirrors. It's no tricks. It's just, here's the time frame. Here's where it begins. Now we do the math. 69 Sabbath years, 69 sevens, is 483 years. We've already discerned that that's the case. I just bring that again to your attention. Okay. Now, if the beginning point, the issuing of the decree, occurs at 444 B.C., and the length before the Messiah comes is 483, then that brings us to 39 A.D. What happened in 39 A.D.? Well, I don't know exactly. Probably a lot of things, not much to do with this, though. We need to take a slightly closer look. Let's go from fuzzy to fine-tuned. And we'll make another point right here that needs to be made. That in Daniel's writing and in the biblical world and the ancient world in general, time was tracked by a lunar calendar over what is called regnal years. Now, what do I mean by that? When we talk about the reign of these kings, like we have in the book of Daniel, Daniel doesn't say, I, Daniel, am writing in 539 B.C., right? Why doesn't he do that? Because there's no C to B, right? And there's no C to B.C. Okay, it's just I'm writing in this year of this king's reign. That's how the whole ancient world functioned. The Romans, when they write history, they're doing the same thing in the third year of the reign of Tiberius, in the second year of the reign of Herod, or whatever it is. They don't have that sort of timeline like we have today. It didn't exist. They used regnal years. They marked time relative to the dominant power of their day. And their years, yes, were a little different than ours. Why? Because they tracked the year over a 360-day series of lunar cycles from full moon to full moon. That's how that worked. See, that's the easiest way for them to understand what completes a cycle of a month is the moon going through all of its full phases. You add that together over 12 months, you get 360 days. That was their year. Funny thing is that what that always means is that they're off by a little bit, right? And so what they had to do is they would stick in an extra month now and then. So that they're, you know, so that spring didn't end up being fall and summer didn't end up being winter. It's that type of deal. So to really get it and to understand that when we talk about hard dates in history, the modern historian is not using a lunar calendar and marking off regnal years. We're talking about hard, specific dates on a timeline. Like when I said 444 BC, we can correlate that exactly through astrological things that have occurred, comets, things like that that occur regularly and which the literature reflect and comments on. And in that way, historians can absolutely, with incredible accuracy, point out or fill out the entire timeline of the ancient world. It can be done by those hard dates, but once those dates are set, they are related to each other over a solar year, our years, which is how many days? 365. So there's a 5-day difference between a solar and a lunar year, right? That's why the Chinese New Year keeps switching, you know. It's like, I'm ready, but oh, it's not ready for me, you know. You have to go back to it later. Okay. So here's what we want to do. We want to be very precise in our analysis of this. The actual calculation of the number of days of this prophecy, 483 years for the 69 Sabbath years, times the number of days in the year, that's 360 days. How many days is that? 173,880. Is that right, Paco? Okay, he's got his calculator right there, but I'm sure I'm right. And if we want to translate that those number of days and into solar years that we actually use to mark history, then we just divide those number of days by the number of days in that year, a 365-day year, which changes then the number of years of this prophecy from 483 to 476. It's not magic. It's just a conversion from lunar to solar years. That's all we're saying here. That's how we mark historical chronology in the modern era. Therefore, we go back and we say, okay, we know for sure that Artaxerxes' edict was given in 444 BC in the spring. 476 years that are those 69 Sabbath years of the prophecy, 476 years, that's the time span, brings us to 32 AD. I'm good. Thank you. All right. Now, here's just one more detail, and then we're done with details, okay? One more small detail. It's a small detail. In a number line, what is the difference between minus 1 and plus 1? How many numbers? 2. Why? Because there's 0, right? Okay, here's the weird thing. When historians map out history, there's no such thing as 0 year, right? When were you born? Well, I was born in 0, you know. Well, no, it doesn't work like that. I was either born in the last year before Christ, B.C., or I was born in the first year, Anno Domini, the year of the Lord, one or the other. So there's a difference on a timeline. The difference between minus 1 and plus 1 is 1, whereas on a number line, the difference between minus 1 and plus 1 is 2. So we want to add a year, since we've been using the number line. That brings us to 33 A, B. Which I want to impress upon you is absolutely the best date for the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and his subsequent arrest, mock trial, and execution. And just so that you are really kind of with the program here, I want to step back for a second, and I want to suggest to you that what we're describing is not smoke and mirrors, not flim-flam, not some weird Christian interpretation. I want to give you some data from ancient historical sources, citing the British historian F.F. Bruce, who has culled through both Jewish and Roman literature on the subject. I've done a little bit of this myself over the last few weeks. He says, and this is his conclusion, he says, we have to account for the widespread belief attested not only by Josephus, he is a Jewish historian of the first century, in his book Jewish Wars, and there's the reference, but also by Tacitus, that's a Roman historian, a Gentile, and Suetonius, another first century Roman historian, that the sacred writings of the Jews pointed to the emerging of a world ruler from Judea at that very time. Josephus points out that Daniel, unlike other Hebrew prophets, was enabled to point to the time at which his predictions would be fulfilled. The ancient Jewish people looked at Daniel and they said, my God, this is going to happen. We didn't know 444 BC. They couldn't put it together with the precision that we can, but they knew the general time frame. They knew the general time frame, and they believed and they wrote that God's Messiah was to break into human history in their lifetimes. That is just a matter of historic fact rooted in the same text that we've been looking at here this evening. Okay? Second, Jesus was in fact crucified under Pontius Pilate, which gives us a very narrow window of when that could have occurred. And so both Jewish and Roman sources make this fact known. Josephus on the Jewish side says Pilate, at the suggestion of principal men among us, had condemned him, that is Jesus in context, to the cross. And Tacitus writes that Christians got their name from Christos, or Christ, who was executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. So again, these are solid first century historical documents saying the exact same thing that we're describing here. When does this prophecy come to its completion? It's in our day. It's in our lifetime. And also this unequivocal fact that it's not just the New Testament saying it or whatever. It is historians saying that these things went down very specifically. The point of Jesus' ministry, according to Jesus, he says in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, he says, the Son of Man, that's the term Daniel keeps using for the Messiah. Remember that from some weeks back? From Daniel 7? He said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. That's Jesus' understanding of his purpose. He didn't come to the earth just to be a nice guy, to show young kids that they ought to share their lunch with others or the brotherhood of man or whatever, you know, thing we want to turn Jesus into in our day, something that's gentle and that we can accommodate and makes us feel good about ourselves. No, Jesus says, here's why I came. I came to buy you out of bondage. That's what ransom is, to buy you out. That we human beings we're alienated from God. We're not born in right relationship with God. We're born in a creation that is far from God, in a the race of humanity that is in rebellion against God. We all want to do our own thing. We want to go our own way. We have our American dream or whatever dream it is. And that is our substitute God, and that is what we're about. And the Bible says that creates a barrier. That's a problem between the God who is your creator and you who is his creation. And that's a barrier that you can't work your way out of. You can't buy your way out of. You can't perform your way out of. There's nothing you can do to make yourself able to get out of the pit that you're in from the biblical point of view. And so the cool thing, the good news, that's what gospel means, good news. The good news is that God has chosen to do for you what you could not do for yourself. That he took upon himself the burden of your guilt, the death that we deserve, so that we would not have to die, so that we would not have to experience the judgment of God. It's just like the Old Testament prophet Isaiah says, as for my people, who considered that the Messiah was taken out of the living for the sin of my people to whom the stroke was due? They couldn't believe it. People looked around and they said, what did Jesus really accomplish? That's what Daniel's saying here. It appears that he accomplished nothing. He was a failure. He came. He got betrayed by his own guys. He got executed in the most disgusting of ways. On a cross. That doesn't seem like victory. And yet, oh man, that was exactly the victory that God was intending, because it's through his death that the whole issue of our standing before God has been dealt with, finally finished. And that is the message that Jesus spoke. That is the message that Daniel is describing. That is the message that Isaiah anticipates. That is what Christ came to do. Awesome. Now in Luke 19, Jesus works his way into Jerusalem. This is Palm Sunday. It says, when he approached Jerusalem, it says that he saw the city and he wept over it, saying, if you had known in this day the things that make for peace, but the day will come on you when your enemies will surround you and hem you in on every side. They will level you to the ground and your children within you. They will not leave one stone upon another. And then he says this, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And Jesus is uttering these words in the month of Nisan, 476 years after the decree of Artaxerxes in 444 BC that set off the time clock that would terminate in the revealing of God's Messiah, who would then be killed. And that's exactly, of course, what happens to Jesus a week later. But notice, too, that Jesus says another thing. He said, the whole city is going to be destroyed. Just like Daniel said, right? In Daniel 9, verse 26. The city is going to be destroyed after the Messiah is killed. Well, actually, in 70 AD, the Roman general Titus entered into the city of Jerusalem. He slew huge numbers of the Jewish people living in the city. He destroyed its walls. He burnt the temple to the ground. And he fulfilled this very picture that Daniel has described, in which Jesus said, it's coming. It's coming. And so the whole picture from history just absolutely fits hand in glove with the description that Daniel gives, writing as he does in the 500s BC. It's amazing. And so let's just draw some conclusions here and kind of recap the thing. First, Daniel's prophecy was written centuries before the time of Christ. There is no debate on this point. We have physical evidence of Daniel's prophecy in the Dead Sea Scrolls and commentaries on them also in the Dead Sea Scrolls written before the time of Christ. This is not made up. Absolutely no one holds that view. Not some kind of convenient description after the fact. Second, the Jews were looking for their Messiah in the first century based in part and significant part on this very passage that we're reading here this evening with the same sort of mathematics, the same understanding of that time flow exactly as we're describing it here. On that, there is no dispute. Third, Christ was crucified in 33 AD, and the city and the temple were destroyed in 70, just as Daniel described. And there is no doubt on that point. And so, the real question is this. That's what God has laid out for you. God has spoken to the progress of human history. God has spoken to what his intent for humanity is and how he will accomplish it through his Messiah. He doesn't want you to guess with respect to his intent. He doesn't want you to wonder, gosh, what does God really want from me? He's laid it out for us in specific detail. I've come to take upon myself the burden of your sin so that you can stand before God completely acceptable because of what I've done for you. The substitutionary death of Christ for you. Okay. And that's the message of the Bible, Old Testament. That's the message of the Bible, New Testament. It's the whole deal. And in this text, he's telling us when that's going to go down. And it did. That's God's case to you. And so then he is calling on us, okay. Now, what will I do with that? What will I do with that information? Well, let me suggest to you that you come before God and say, really? This is so amazing that you would have outlined what you're going to do in history hundreds of years before it comes to pass, just so that I might know with some objectivity what your intent toward me is. Here's the verdict that God is calling you to, that God is speaking to your heart about. He's saying, I've moved history to communicate to you because I love you, because I want relationship with you, because you matter to me. And I'm asking you, will you simply open your heart and receive the gift that I want to give to you, the gift of forgiveness that comes with no strings attached based upon the work of Christ for you? And in that moment, in that time where you're able just to say, yes, God, that is what I want. And I want to stand my ground before you on the basis of what you've done for me, not my own native goodness. Then at that moment, at that time, Jesus says, we have the privilege and the right to become children of God. We're brought right into his family. There's no more hostility. There's nothing. And so he's calling to you to receive his forgiveness. That's what this is about. This is why the elaborate thing that he's laid out there. He wants you to wrestle with this. He wants you to think it through. Maybe you're ready here tonight. Maybe you sense that, oh, man, this is true. we're going to pray here in a minute. I'm just going to ask you, why don't you just go ahead and pray like we've described and let Christ come into your life. Maybe you're hearing stuff here that you've just never thought about before, and you're like, you got to be kidding me. I want more information. I need to think this through. Well, you know, there are some very important books on this subject, because Daniel 9 is one of a web of many very specific descriptions of the coming Messiah, as we've described earlier. There are many other avenues of evidence that God has given to us. You may want to look at some of that. We have a free book for you as a guest called Christianity, the Faith That Makes Sense. It outlines some of that information. You may want to dig even deeper than that. There are books in our bookstore that go into much more detail on each of these points. You can pick those up at basically our cost. But whatever it is, and wherever you are, my plea to you is that you respond to what God is showing you. Respond to that. Because this is real. This is history. This is fact. And from that fact, he's calling you to relationship. Let's just pray together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.